Today, Mitch Jeserich is in conversation with Thomas Frank on U.S. history and politics. Guest, Thomas Frank is a historian and columnist and the author of such books as What's the Matter with Kansas and Listen Liberal. His latest book is a collection of essays called Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society, Letters in Politics, airs every afternoon at 6 p.m. on WMNF's HD3 channel, The Source. Now, here's Thomas Frank.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jeserich. Thomas Frank is here. Thomas Frank is a historian and columnist known for his humorous yet piercing critiques of American politics. He's the author of many books, including What's the Matter with Kansas, Listen Liberal, and his latest collection of essays. It's called Rendezvous with Oblivion. Wow. Rendezvous with Oblivion.
Yes.
Welcome. It's good to have
Mitch,
you here.
It's good to see you again.
It's quite a time. I usually never ask about a title as my first question of a book because I feel like then I'm doing television.
Okay,
news.
So I've been in a bad mood for quite a while, and Trump's election it brought it all home to me. And so the title is a play on, so nobody remembers this anymore, but Franklin Roosevelt once gave a very famous speech. I think it was right before World War II, and the high point of the speech, the high point of the speech, he says, "This generation has a rendezvous with destiny."
Yeah.
And I always loved that, you know, and it was so, and that's exactly right. You think for that generation, and what a thing to say, and he really nailed it there. And, for us, it's the opposite. This generation has a rendezvous with oblivion.
Well, I'm looking at the titles.
I don't want to be too negative about this, though, Mitch, because I'm going to go on to write other books. And I'm going to try to say hopeful things.
Yeah. Do you have to try?
I'm going to raise the Titanic.
Well, I'm just looking at the... I think I'm noticing a narrative thread here of the titles of your books from 2004 on. And you've written books before then. But just let me go through this list. And I'm omitting a couple because it serves my purpose to do so. But 2004, What's the Matter with Kansas? Yeah. How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. 2006, What's the Matter with America?
That's actually just the UK edition of...
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah, of Kansas.
Oh.
The French title is even more outrageous.
What was the French title?
It's a Pourquoi les pauvres votent à droite? Why the poor vote for the right? And then they have the title of Listen Liberal is the opposite. Why the rich vote for the left?
All right, so my faux pas, but let me continue with what I'm trying to say.
You're exactly right.
Because then you get The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule, and then Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, and now Rendezvous.
The sort of sinking trajectory there.
Yes.
And you know what my next one's going to be called?
What?
The People Know, N-O. Remember the book in the 30s, The People Yes?
No.
Okay. Carl Sandburg wrote an epic poem about the people, the common man. It's the 30s, the great age of the proletarian age, you know. And anyhow, so I'm going to flip his title. Okay, maybe I'm not going to do that. I don't even know why I told you that. Now somebody, some smart Berkeley professor is going to be like, oh, that's a good one. I hope myself.
Well, look out for it. We'll have this archive so we can.
Yes,
maybe
that's
use
right.
It.
And that, by the way, yeah. So that one, I shouldn't even talk about that. I mean, I don't know how you have a second act after Rendezvous with Oblivion. I don't know. Look, it's a good title.
It got me to ask you about it. Like I said, I feel like if I ask about a title right at the beginning of the interview, I feel like it's television.
By the way, it's one of those titles I've used it before because I like to use famous quotes and sort of flip them around, and. I've used it before. It's one of my favorite titles. I've used it for newspaper columns. I have a bunch of titles like that, and this book I used all of them as section titles, titles of the essays and stuff like that. So now I've retired all of my sort of recurring themes. All done. I'm starting over after this one, Mitch. Turning over a new leaf.
Well, before you do that, let's really run this through all the way. And I'm going to quote you now from your introduction of this book. And here it is. Quote, The the consolations of ideology became available to the millions thanks to Facebook and Twitter and the political entertainers on cable news. Millions of Americans came to believe that everything was political and that therefore everything was faked, that everyone was a false accuser, so why not accuse people falsely, that any complaint or objection could ultimately be confounded by some clever meme. Or they or their TV heroes had discovered the made-up argument by which they could drown out that still small voice of reality.
Yeah, that's our time. That's where we are. So I'm going to read from that tonight, that section. I'm going to talk about that some tonight. But that's, yeah, I was just on Twitter this morning, and that's exactly what it is. And I'm both addicted to it and I hate it. Do you know what I mean? I'm on there and, you know, I have all these people that I follow and I love to see them getting the best of everyone. And it's so, you know, saying, you know, clever put downs after someone has written an essay or whatever. But there's also something extremely unhealthy about the climate that we're in. I like that. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say I like a phrase when I myself wrote it. The consolations of ideology, you know, but that's what I'm really after there is the Fox News phenomenon. And I don't know if you know anyone whose brain has been taken over by Fox News. Have you ever encountered this?
Yes, I have family. I'm a white guy with family.
Yeah, it's a strange. It's a strange thing.
And I watch a lot of Fox News.
I don't anymore.
I
did
know
once.
What they're doing. Especially in the evening, I end up watching it just because I feel like I should know what they're saying.
Yeah,
and I feel like Sean Hannity is maybe the most powerful person in the country, not in the White House.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't watch it anymore. Yeah. I did once when I was writing about the conservatives, when I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas and the Wrecking Crew, I watched it all the time. But I don't anymore. But what I'm talking about there is not so much the hosts of the program, but the people that, the way the program is received by, you know, by the people who, and it's a well sort of, not well documented, but a well known phenomenon of, you know, family members, people that we care about who get so into Fox News and they think they have an answer for everything. And it reminds me a lot of ways, and this is a point that I made in a book that you didn't mention called Pity the Billionaire, that it is you know, I've spent a lot of my life studying the 1930s and the sort of culture of the 1930s, and it reminds me in a lot of ways, and this is going to sound strange on KPFA, but it's like the kind of popular front mentality of the 1930s, only with the politics of it reversed, where people suddenly, you know, they understand the world politically, they have the answer to everything, they have this form of political certainty, ideological certainty, and they know that the answers can be filled in later and all that sort of thing. And that's the Fox News mentality, and it's I imagine it is very reassuring, and it's a lot of fun to be one of the people that believes in that. Can I tell you a Fox News story? This goes way back. I remember I was in Hawaii on vacation right before the market crashed in 2000, and all the there was all these retirees, you know, that we were hanging around with, and they were all watching Fox News, and they were the stock market was going up and up and up. This was at, you know, that peak of the bubble, and they were high-fiving each other in the evening as they watched the sunset and all the money that they had made, and they had the world by the tail. You know, they were both extremely prosperous and had this grievance against the world. Like, he complained about the world. The world was unfair. And that's the Fox News message, right? Is you are both affluent and the world doesn't respect you. And the world treats you poorly. And the world discriminates against you. Against you, the affluent, you know, the guy who's worked so hard and done so much. That is really, it is a powerful message and it's a seductive message. And these people are
seduced.
But it's
also geared towards working class white people.
Yes, there's a different message for them. Yeah, they don't high five over the stock market. You know, and I remember a conversation I had with someone at that time, and I'm like, you know, I said, this is just a bubble. And they said, what do you mean? What's that mean? They'd never heard that before. And then, of course, it all came crashing down a short while later. Yeah, their message for working people is different, but it's one of grievance, class-based grievance. And by the way, Mitch, can I just say, this is something, we're changing gears here slightly. This is something I have been writing about for a really long time. So this was the message of What's the Matter with Kansas. That was 15 years ago. And I remember coming here to KPFA and talking about it, that this culture of the grassroots right, the people who are the rank and file voters for the right wing that are powering this revolution along, that the movement speaks to them in terms of social class, and that it tries to gin up class-based grievances, and that this is what the culture wars are. And I don't know of anybody that disagrees with that anymore. There were people who disagreed with it at the time. I don't think anybody disagrees with it anymore. But what's interesting to me is that even though we know that is true now, we still can't figure out, or the Democrats can't seem to figure out what to do about it. And they went from this state of, after that book came out, from denying that it was happening. By the way, this is all of these guys, all of this sort of, right-thinking liberals, New York Times and all this, they denied that it was happening. This is not happening. Working class people are not going over to the Republican Party.
They were hostile to your book?
Very much so. Do you remember, you know who Paul Krugman is?
Yeah, of course.
So he wrote, four or five times in his columns saying that this was not happening and that the Democrats did not have to worry about this. And he specifically said it's not happening in the North. I know, it's so awful, you know. But that was a common journalistic theme. And it came out of political science. There was a bunch of political scientists that denied that this was happening. And that became the sort of received wisdom for a while, that it wasn't happening. Okay, now it's nobody denies it now. And the aftermath of Trump, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, no one denies it anymore. But now they've switched 180 degrees and they said, okay, that is happening and it's irresistible. There's nothing we can do about it. And they never stopped at the halfway point. I know I'm getting off the subject that you wanted to talk about. They never stopped at the halfway point and said, this is happening. Let's do something to stop it. Let's do something to reverse it. They went straight from this isn't happening to this is irresistible. there's nothing we can do. And that's where we are now.
Do you feel as though, and I was going to ask you this, that What's the Matter with Kansas sort of, you were onto something that was coming, obviously.
Yeah, but it was and the book ends looking into the future and saying, you know, everybody says this is, that Kansas has gone too far to the right, but I'm here to tell you this is just getting started. That was like the last couple sentences of the book. But I wrote the book as a work of history. It was supposed to be looking back, you know. For me, the essential event of our lifetimes was the election of Reagan, or even before that, the sort of, the Milton Friedman in the 1970s, the sort of consensus turn to the Chicago School of Economics that you saw. That's the central event of our time. And I have spent my adult life trying to understand how and why it happened and how, I mean, we know why it happened and we know we can understand the economics of it and we can understand why those economics failed. What is difficult to understand is why a democratic nation endorsed that. Why a nation of middle class people endorsed a system that has led to the destruction of their way of life. And it has. No question about it.
And you're right. That is.
And that was the mystery of What's the Matter with Kansas. That's the mystery of everything, but that's the mystery.
And
Kansas is a symbol. You get it?
I do.
Yeah. It's a symbol for us, for middle America, you know.
Well, your book in Europe was called What's the Matter with America.
Exactly.
So, you know, I got all that.
I didn't think they would know what Kansas was. I was wrong about that, by the way. They all knew what Kansas was. You know why? The Wizard of Oz.
Well,
they've
of course
all seen it.
Most famous state in the country, internationally. So let's talk a little about Donald Trump here, even though you bragged to me in your last column you only mentioned him once, which was a real achievement. But you do say, and I do want to talk about the controversial aspects, but you do say there is something that Donald Trump was actually saying that was real for these people.
Yes. So he is different than, I shouldn't say he's different than the other conservatives. I think they probably all had something that was real. What Donald Trump had that the others did not was he actually was cribbing stuff, he was cribbing stuff from people like us, from AFL-CIO, from, people who protest the military-industrial complex. I mean, he, you know, he, if you go back and watch his campaign speeches, this is one of the essays in Rendezvous with Oblivion, he talked about trade agreements all the time and how disastrous they've been for working people and for industry in America. And look, that's true. And I have been writing about that ever since NAFTA was passed. And, you know, so have a bunch of my friends. This is a common left-wing trope. And it was really interesting to see Trump take that and use it to get to the left of Hillary Clinton on this essential issue. Now, that said, Trump knows nothing about trade. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's never bothered to do the research or call up the people who have done the research. And he's, now that he's president, he is just blundering into this.
More tariffs today, yeah, on China.
That's entirely symbolic. The problem with these trade agreements is not that they put the tariffs down to zero. It's that they did all these other things. They set up like these international tribunals where corporations can sue the government. They made it impossible for Mexico to nationalize or even regulate American property in their country. They don't have any standards for labor. You know, all of these treaties were negotiated by lobbyists.
Right.
Labor never had a seat at the table, even with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was Obama. This was a purely Democratic thing. Obama and Hillary were negotiating that, and it was entirely done with trade groups. Not labor had got nothing. And so when Trump is denouncing that, yeah, I'm against that too. And of course, as I said, he knows nothing about it. He was just denouncing it in entirely superficial terms. And now that he's president, we can see he knows nothing about it. He doesn't know how to go about doing anything. But just think of the political blunders that this involved. I mean, Hillary saw it, to her credit, saw it coming and tried to get out of it. You know, said, look, I've changed my mind about the TPP. But nobody believed her.
Right.
And in part, they didn't believe her because here you've got President Obama in his last year in office saying, we're going to get TPP through Congress. And people are like, well, Trump is, you know, making a big stink about this on the campaign trail. Maybe you better lay off. No. He pressed it right up to the election. I just couldn't. We're getting off track here. That'll be my next book. Getting off track, Mitch. Sorry.
Right. No, the table's okay. We're all here. And we'll do the first draft of that book right here. I do find it interesting. Kind of this, I don't know if realignment of issues is the correct way to put it, but trade is definitely one of them. I know for years, as you have,
we've been critical about trade agreements. Trump did talk about lobbyists for the defense contractors being able to sell the Pentagon fighter planes that they didn't need. That's true. He did outrageous things. You were there at the Republican convention. One of the crazier things he did that day when he gave his speech, he promised to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act.
Yeah.
What do you think the chances are of him doing that, Mitch? I mean,
not very likely.
No, it's just a completely cynical ploy to win over, you know, disillusioned Bernie Sanders voters. And
right.
He probably did win some of them with that.
Right.
And I feel sorry for those people.
The issues around NATO, I mean, at least when I say left, I'll say our left, KPFA, Pacifica Radio type of world, you know, we've long been asking why do we still have NATO?
Yeah.
You know, and now there's,
that has
flipped. North Korea, mm-hmm. And some would even argue the right has claimed the issue of free speech.
Yes, but in an awful way. I mean, they've used it as a weapon to pound organized labor over the head. We're just talking about how Trump got elected here. As president, he's been, a completely different thing. But he mixed these selected handful of left-wing issues with xenophobia, racism, you know, the sort of the ugliest kind of politics out there. What does all this have in common? It was class-based appeals. Why is he able to get away with that? I mean, this is a billionaire. This is a guy that lives in a skyscraper in New York. This is a guy that, you know, loves luxury. And you can mock him all day long. We could have a great time just doing a show making fun of his exaggerated, you know, billionaire show-off lifestyle. You know, he did a TV show once called Donald Trump's Fabulous World of Golf.
Isn't his apartment modeled after Louis XIV's
Versailles? That's his taste. Yeah. He loves that. Yeah. How does this work? Ask yourself that. How is a guy able to get away with this? How come the Democratic Party couldn't stop him? You know, couldn't make him into a laughingstock, which he rightfully should be. There's never been a more vulnerable, silly-looking billionaire than this guy. And they couldn't pin that to him. Why not? Because the Democratic Party, and this is the other side of the coin, this is what Listen Liberal was about, and this is what Rendezvous with Oblivion is about, is because the Democratic Party really isn't, you know, their heart isn't in that stuff anymore. You know, when Hillary Clinton was not convincing about the TPP and about NAFTA, and when she says she's changed her mind, it's because she hadn't really changed her mind. She was just saying that, and everybody knew it. And the Democratic Party really doesn't care about working people. You know, they really don't. Except for in terms of campaign contributions and stuff like that. And you can document that in hundreds of ways. The people that they care about are their wealthy pals on Wall Street and in Silicon Valley who they love, right? That's the creative industries. That's the future. They love that stuff. This is a chronic problem for the Democratic Party, and it's 100 times worse now. I mean, Trump, for all of his blustering and his folly, he spotted this. He saw their weak point, and he hammered right at it. Now, the thing is, what are they going to do now to fix it? I don't know, Mitch. I don't know. I don't see that many hopeful signs on the horizon. I mean, this woman that just got elected in the Bronx, that's a good sign.
Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah,
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah, yeah. I'm very happy about that. Yeah. And there are other good signs here and there. But by and large, you know, I live in Washington. The Democratic Party shows no desire to change. Some candidates here and there do. But by and large, they will come up with any explanation, any casuistry, any form of reasoning that will allow them to get off the hook and not change who they are, not change their relationship with their donors, not change, the nature of the Democratic Party, anything.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with historian and columnist Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank is the author of a number of books. His latest is a collection of essays called Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. Thomas Frank, for our listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, will be speaking tonight in Berkeley at St. John's Presbyterian Church at 7:30 tonight. That's 2727 College Avenue. Again, that's in Berkeley, St. John's Presbyterian Church at 7:30 tonight. And we'll give those details throughout our conversation. Thomas Frank, I do want to say something and get your take on it about the issue of working class white voters and those folks. And I do believe that economics was a part of it. Trade probably was a part of it. Way of life was a part of it.
Yeah.
Concern really about the future, I think, was maybe even more than those other things about what was going to happen to them down the line.
Yeah.
But I also believe, and I'm not from the Midwest, I've always lived on one of the coasts, but I grew up in a small town in California, which is much more like the rest of the country than people may realize.
Yeah.
And I do believe that working class white people, a number of them equally, were put off by the embrace of Democrats, even if, albeit maybe reluctantly, of its acceptance and its embrace of multiculturalism. Yeah. And I do think racism plays a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I do believe a lot of these people even voted for Barack Obama, because we do know that there are many people who voted for Obama than Trump. But I think they voted for Obama thinking, great, racism's done. Now we don't have to hear about it anymore. And of course, they heard a whole lot more about it because then you get the rise of Black Lives Matters.
Yeah.
And I don't think the Democrats, I think it would be a bad strategy for the Democrats to try to appeal to these people on that basis.
Of course. Well, you can't. Yeah, this is an important point. And of course, that is true. It's very difficult to document, you know, precisely how these things work out. Like, is it economic fear? Is it, you know, is it some kind of legitimate grievance, like the trade stuff we were just talking about? Is it these racial fears? Is it xenophobia? Is it just outright hate? And we do know, like, the far right, the sort of racist right, your neo-fascist, you know, types were gung-ho about Donald Trump, still are, you know, super psyched, you know, held that rally in Charlottesville, by the way, where I went to college. Still astonishing to me that that happened there. I just can't believe it.
And Charlottesville is a pretty, you know, it's a college town.
Oh, yeah. Also like, you know, it wasn't particularly liberal when I was a student there in the 1980s, but they sure as hell wouldn't allow something like that, you know? How that happened, you know, is...
Well, I think people from outside went there.
Oh, you know, of course, yeah. Exactly, but why they chose there and why, you know, it's well, Thomas Jefferson's
University. You should have saw Berkeley like, last year.
Oh, right, that's right. They did that here, too, didn't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Look, that is going on, no question about it. And I, you know, but like you, I know people that voted for Obama and then switched to Trump. And we know that there's all of those counties in the Midwest. There's a Washington Post, big Washington Post think piece about there's a whole string of counties in the upper Mississippi Valley, in Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois that went for Obama twice and then went for Trump. And they interviewed all of these people there, you know. This is a well-documented phenomenon. There have been all of these studies of white working-class voters, and that is certainly part of it. But I would suggest to you, I mean, that's the thing about that is that that offers, I don't think there's any way that, I mean, the Democratic Party can get out in front of a racist groundswell. That would be a horrible thing to try to do, and I would hate to see the Democratic Party try to do it. Now, your listeners are probably saying, well, that's crazy. They've never done something like that. They actually have. Bill Clinton did that. That's what welfare reform was, mm-hmm. and that's what mass incarceration of black kids was. That's the crime bill of 1994. That's what it was.
Clinton's super predator.
Yep. They have, in other words, they have tried that before, and that's I would hate to see them go that direction again. I can't stand that stuff. If you've read my writing, probably the best part of Listen Liberal is when I talk about, you know, welfare reform and the crime bill. It's just like that stuff turns my stomach. So that said, what do they do? The strategy is actually obvious once you put it in those terms. You have to reach out to working class people somehow. What way do you have? it's obvious. It's like they're working class people. Economics, you know, class issues.
Right.
And there are, I think, plenty of people who can be brought back to the Democratic Party, who for whatever reason, you know, went for Trump over Hillary. I want to remind you of something else, that 2016 was a populist year across the board, that it wasn't just Trump. There was also Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also Brexit in England. There's something going on, and it's not just xenophobia and racism. There's also, I mean,
We have López Obrador this year in Mexico.
Exactly. It's on it rolls. You know, this is... this is a cry for help. There's, you know, in some ways, you know, I think back to 2008, which is, as the saying that I never get tired of repeating, one of my favorite sayings, that was the turning point, Mitch, and we didn't make the turn. We missed the turn. But the hope of that year, hope that we had a real leader in Barack Obama, a new Franklin Roosevelt, as I like to say. I mean, that's who I thought he was at the time. Became sort of curdled into desperation. In French, espoir, hope, the opposite of it is despair, désespoir. And that's sort of what you saw with Donald Trump, you know? It's in some ways a weird, it's another side to what we saw in 2008. An ugly, curdled, bitter side, but it's also the Sanders phenomenon. After once you've completely succeeded in destroying that and insulting the people who had signed up for that, you know, all these things are. I'm sorry, I talk too much.
Well, that's what I brought you on here.
So one of my favorite essays.
I'm not objecting.
Can I say one of my favorite essays in Rendezvous with Oblivion is about. The way the Washington Post treated Bernie Sanders, which sounds highly specific, but again, I'm using the Post as an example because it's one of our country's leading newspapers, and it also happens to be the daily newspaper in the city where I live. And I read every op-ed and editorial they wrote that mentioned Bernie Sanders for 6 months in 2016 when he was a going concern and might possibly have won the Democratic nomination. And their hostility to him was overwhelming. It was totally out of relation to his the offense that the man gives. I mean, his proposals were not outrageous. He himself is not a villain. He doesn't, he plays by the rules. He wears a suit and tie every day. He's, he's not Donald Trump. He's not a demagogue.
I mean, he's an independent, but he votes with
the
Democratic caucus.
He plays well with the other members of the Senate of both parties. He gets along famously with them. But they treated him as though he was this outlandish, unacceptable, heretical.
Well, people thought he was going to give us Donald Trump. Remember? He can't beat Trump. We can't take the risk.
I know.
We got to put up Clinton.
Yes, I know. I shouldn't laugh about that because you just think of the mistakes that were made.
Yeah,
you weren't at the Democratic convention, but
not the last time. But I heard about it.
But she had all of these people that she could have chosen for her VP. By the way, one of the hallmarks of the Clintons, specifically the Clintons, is that they never extend an olive branch to the left of the party, to the other wing of the party. So Bill Clinton chose Al Gore. He chose another guy from the Democratic Leadership Council. And Al Gore did the same. He chose Lieberman.
Yeah.
And now it's Hillary's turn.
And John McCain regrets not choosing Lieberman.
He could have lost twice. That would have been extraordinary. For two different parties. Hillary, she could have chosen Bernie Sanders. It would have been a nice thing. It would have been a nice olive branch, make peace with these people who were very unhappy about the way their candidate had been treated. And I think she would have, that would have done it for her. That would have prevented.
Yeah, Tim Kaine was was not an aspiring choice.
No, to say the least.
Yeah.
And, what a blunder that was.
Yeah.
But there are many such blunders like that. Many, 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 many.
And even if not Bernie, there are other people.
Elizabeth Warren.
One of the Castro brothers.
There's so many. I mean, there are so many things, other people that she could have chosen. But no, she wanted someone similar to herself that wouldn't overshadow her in any way. And
she got him.
Yep.
Yeah.
But made no outreach to the left of the party. And didn't even send Bernie out, could have had him all over the country giving speeches, doing whatever it is he promised to do. Didn't even do that. Didn't send, what a disaster.
So here's the other thing that I want to say about Hillary Clinton. And that is, it's really remarkable if you look at her two presidential runs. And sometimes, again, and we're talking a lot about that white working class voter. But Hillary Clinton has had two presidential runs, and in both of them, she was going up what was seen at the time as the improbable candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody thought Barack Obama was going to win when he first announced his nomination, and he wins. He beats Hillary Clinton. Nobody thought Donald Trump was going to beat Hillary Clinton.
Yep.
Well, he did.
I know.
If you even look, and correct me if I'm misremembering this because I didn't go back to check it, but I believe Democrats might have even picked up a couple of seats in Congress in 2016. So it's not like, never mind Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by a million.
Three million. Yeah. She won the popular vote fairly convincingly.
And so, take all of that, and nobody, I didn't think Donald Trump was going to win the election. So, if people actually thought he had a chance, who knows what the results then would have been in those three states that ultimately decided, Wisconsin, Michigan.
Yeah, Pennsylvania.
I mean, we pay a lot of attention to a certain group who we think gave the election to Donald Trump. But I mean, there's just so much more.
Of course. And when an election is decided and the votes in those states that you just mentioned, it was so close in those states that, I mean, basically, Mitch, you can point to like five different factors and say, well, this swung enough votes to make the difference, this swung enough votes to make the difference, et cetera, et cetera. I like to focus on the working class subject because that's the long-term historical trend going back to Nixon. That's the Republicans figuring out that they can court this core Democratic constituency and have gradually, very slowly over time.
Is this an extension of the Southern strategy?
Yeah, definitely. Although, so what... Trump looks to Nixon. Trump admires Nixon. He mimics Nixon. It mimics his phrases, I should say. Repeats his phrases. He also repeats Reagan's phrases. Make America Great Again was a Reagan phrase. Trump swiped that.
A Lindbergh phrase, right?
That's America First.
Oh, my bad. Forgive me.
Very few people remember that one, but yes, it was... This is an extension of the Southern strategy, although it's not Southern anymore, and it's sort of been stripped of those. But yes, absolutely. That was, by the way, I don't like to keep going back to What's the Matter with Kansas, but that was the idea of What's the Matter with Kansas, was let's document a state that's made this right turn that's not in the South. Because everybody up till then had written about the Southern strategy and what had gone, you know, how the South went from being Democratic to being Republican. But I was saying, I mean, Kansas has always been Republican, but it changed from your sort of Dwight D. Eisenhower style Republican, your Alf Landon Republican, to your Sam Brownback Republican, and that was a remarkable shift. And so I wanted to write about that specifically happening somewhere that wasn't in the South. And now that's it's happening all over the place. California's going the other way, by the way.
Yeah. Let me remind folks who are talking, I have a lot to say about that. We are in conversation with Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank, historian, columnist, author of a number of books. The latest, which is a collection of essays, is called Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society for our listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area. Thomas Frank will be speaking tonight at St. John's Presbyterian Church at 7:30. That's at 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley. So again, tonight at 7:30 at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley. I'll give those details when we wrap up at the top of the hour. I actually ran into you this morning as you were jogging.
Yeah, that's right.
We came into the station when you were on another show, and I was explaining to you at the time. We're a heavily Democratic state. Our local city councils are run by Democrats. Our counties are run by Democrats almost exclusively, and at the state level we have almost a super majority at that level. Yet it's a very hard place to live. I have neighbors who are now living out on the street, and you know, it's a very fierce place to be unless you make six figures.
Yeah.
And this is all happening under Democratic local control.
Yeah, it turns out that the Democrats are really not the party of working people anymore, that they really are the party of the sort of affluent white-collar set. And they look at Silicon Valley and they see the future, and they think that's just the most wonderful thing in the world. And they look at Wall Street and it's the same. You know, so that was the big mystery that Listen Liberal tried to unravel. You know, everything from why the Obama administration didn't get tough with Wall Street after the financial crisis, which he could have done very easily, to, you know, why they fail us in, why you have places like this. The place I focused on was Boston, Massachusetts, or the state of Massachusetts, which is similar. It's completely controlled from top to bottom by Democrats, except for the governor. But they have enough in the state legislature; they can override anything. They can do whatever they want, and still you have the most incredible inequality in that state, just unbelievable. And also the higher education, the focus on the Democrats have come to really identify themselves with higher education, with universities as the fount of all that is good about American life. And here we are. So on my jog this morning, I went through the campus of the University of California here, which is very beautiful. And that's always the sort of the anchor of these, that's the anchor of the Democratic vision. It's always college towns. By the way, you look at maps of some of these states like Missouri, where Missouri used to be a Democratic state. This is Harry Truman country, you know, Stuart Symington. Dick Gephardt was from Missouri. And now I think Trump won. He won every county except for Kansas City, St. Louis, and the college town. And so this is one of the essays in Rendezvous with Oblivion. I go to Walt Disney's hometown, by the way, which is a little town about 100 miles north of Kansas City. And it's where, if you ever go to Disneyland, Main Street USA is based on the main street of this town. And the town is, I don't want to run the town down because it's, I like Missouri and I like small town America. But let me just put it this way. No one would ever build a replica of it now. You know, and this county, the county that it's in, I think went for Trump by 70%. Or 80%, something like this. This is just running up these extreme totals in these places. And these are places that have been deindustrialized. You know, the small farmers are wiped out. You know, the Walmart has taken over the downtown. I mean, the vacancy rate in the downtown of these, some of the towns in that part of Missouri are just, it's just staggering. You know, the building just standing there boarded up. It's just, you know, and these people have converted to Republicanism even as their life, as their fortunes have gone through the meat grinder. They identify now with the party of, you know, Herbert Hoover. It boggles the mind, Mitch. It makes you crazy. And our Democratic leaders can't figure out what to do about it. They can't figure out how they might speak to people whose lives have been ruined. Okay, I'm speechless now.
I mean, I think the title of your next book is just going to be "To Hell with It." Burn it all down.
Yeah. Remember Howard Jarvis? I'm mad as hell.
Yeah.
And he did.
And it worked.
Burn it all down.
And it worked. Well, speaking of mad as hell, I want to ask you about one of the chapters based on the essay in your book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, called "The Bully Pulpit." And it's about,
by the way, I'm one of my favorite essays in this. It's I don't think anybody read it when it came out. It was in Harper's Magazine. It was about
Andrew Breitbart.
Right, which
I think we still know the name Breitbart because of Breitbart News. But I think when we think of Breitbart now, we think of Steve Bannon, formerly Milo Yiannopoulos.
Yeah.
But we forget about Andrew Breitbart, who died.
Yeah, interesting guy, though. I mean, interesting to me. I mean, he's what you think about him, or what you know, was this scowling, ranting, right-wing jerk, you know, snarling, and he loved to yell at people. He loved to be mean to people, to liberals specifically. But what was interesting to me, so I met him once in person, and I was astonished to find that when the cameras were off, he was like a normal individual, like a really normal guy. He actually told me something funny. Can I repeat it?
Please. Well,
it's clean. It's clean.
Okay.
We were waiting to go on a TV show, and he said to me...
But speak in the mic.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Mitch. Yeah, I forget every now and then. I'm so... we were waiting to go on a TV show, and he said to me, you know, when I say such and such, you know, because he had all his lines down, you know, it was a role that he played. He said, when I say such and such, lean across the table and punch me in the face. and people will love you forever. And I was like, you know, of course I wasn't going to do that. Right. I'm a nice guy and everything, but that was kind of a funny thing to say. And so I dug around a little, and it turned out he had, the other thing in this one conversation I had with him, we talked about Spy magazine. When I was young, I started my own magazine. It was called The Baffler. And our model was, this may sound strange, but our model was Spy magazine. We loved, my friends and I loved Spy magazine. This is in the 80s. And if, for those of you who don't remember what Spy was, it was this sort of savage war on celebrities and on Donald Trump, among others. They loved to make fun of Donald Trump, but any celebrity was fair game. And it was the funniest magazine you ever saw. My friends and I absolutely adored it. And they also did a lot of pranks. They loved to prank Donald Trump. They would come up with these hilarious ways to fool him. But, my friends and I loved this magazine, and I thought, well, that's odd. What, you know, Andrew Breitbart liked Spy magazine. He loved it. And he had, it turns out he also hated celebrity. And in fact, you know, I started digging into his past. He wrote a book about how much he hated celebrities. He grew up in Los Angeles around all of these movie stars. He was from like Brentwood or something like that. And so he, you know, lived in that culture and just grew to despise it. And I think that's honorable beginnings. Okay, I agree with him on that. I happen to agree with him on that. The funny thing is that carried him along to this extreme place on the right, to this ugly, ugly place on the right where it's all about being insulting and being a false accuser. Remember what he did with Shirley Sherrod, what he did with Acorn. So he made his mark as a false accuser. You know, and it carried him along to a really ugly place. But he intrigued me as someone who started from what I thought was honorable beginning, a point of beginning that is okay, you know, despising celebrity. I think that's very wholesome. Jeffersonian even. That's, you know, or Thomas Paine, you know, that is who we are, you know. We don't like aristocrats in this country. But it carried him along to a terrible place. And that's what my essay about him is about. Now, by the way, I'm proud of that essay. I talk too much. I'm so sorry, Mitch.
That's why we have you on, Thomas Frank. You shouldn't be so self-conscious of it. I mean, it's interesting, but I see this, and I guess this is a co-development then that you have with social media. As you said, you love and hate Twitter.
Yeah.
And I'm at this point where I'm realizing
Twitter was Andrew Breitbart's one true love.
And I'm a little worried this isn't necessarily for me, which is going to be problematic as we move forward as in media, because I think social media is so much about it. But what gets retweets, what gets shared are things that are really edgy and explosive.
Mean. Things that are mean.
And those are the things. Like if you put
things
something
that
out, that, if you're trying to be just reasoned,
yeah, forget
measured,
it. Forget it.
No one
cares.
Nothing happens.
Yeah. No, it's only the outrageous, only the preposterous, only the mean, only the cruel. We set a high premium on that. By the way, and that was Andrew Breitbart. Once he discovered that, you know, there was no stopping him. One of the funnier stories
from
his life.
But I don't see it just from the right.
No, of course, absolutely. It's on the left, too. Twitter is... I mean, I don't want to denounce it. I'm on Twitter, and I'm on Facebook.
You have to be.
Yeah, and I kind of enjoy both of them. But, you know, as someone who spent his life in journalism, you know, writing essays that I work over and I labor over, and I try to get facts right. You know, and that's important in my business. You know, that's all gone. By the way, that's another, when we say rendezvous with oblivion and why are you so negative, Frank, a big part of this is the demise of newspapers in this country. That is a big part of the background of this book. I mean, how do you have, and also, by the way, while that's, so can I tell you another interesting anecdote? The demise of newspapers and the slow sinking of academia, which is one of the main subjects in this book. I got a PhD in history back in the 90s, American history. That was my field. And I set out to, you know, become a professor and discovered right away that teaching history had been casualized and you had to take a job as an adjunct and you get paid very, very little, but you do the same work as an ordinary professor. They had just somehow casualized the labor. This is, by the way, people with the most advanced degrees in American life. So whenever anybody tells you education is the key to prosperity, it's like, well, not if that means getting a PhD. It's kind of the opposite, you know. You're going in the other direction then. But then I started looking into academia as a whole. So while academia is casualizing the actual work of teaching, the actual work of the transmission of knowledge.
What do you mean by that, casualizing?
When they're making it, they're putting it in the hands of people with no health care and no job security and no tenure.
Adjuncts
and grad students. That's who's doing the teaching. It's more than 50%. Oh, it's much more than 50% now of the courses taught in America are taught by not by people on the tenure track. And you can document that very easily over time, how that has increased and increased and increased. And as that has happened, you've also seen that the price of tuition explode in this country. Explode.
Yeah.
So I went to the University of Chicago for graduate school. To go there as an undergrad now costs $70,000 a year. Nobody can afford that.
This is a serious threat to democracy.
Yeah, it certainly is. When you have institutions like that that are both falling apart and jacking up the price at the same time, you know, and then newspapers falling apart. By the way, so in my own life, those are the two things that I, you know, my first ambition was to be a historian, to be a professor. And when that was, it was clear that that was not, you know, I could do it, but I was never going to make a living at it. At the same time, this is in the
90s. You didn't expect to go into poverty because of that.
No, of course not. I wanted to be like the people that I admired in life, my professors. That's, you know, I looked up to them. I wanted to be like them. I wanted to do what they had done, you know, teach undergraduates and write books and talk with your colleagues and, you know, the, what a university is for. That's what I wanted to do in life. And as it became clear that that was not available to my generation anymore, I was writing articles for the Chicago Reader at the same time. And I wrote one about a, it doesn't matter what it was about anymore, but I got paid more for that one article than I did for an entire semester of adjunct work. And I said to myself, wow, journalism. So here's the punchline, Mitch. I went into journalism for the money.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And now that's dead.
Wow. How do you feel about that now?
I know. That's dead. Academia, dead. And you start to wonder, and, you know, and everything has migrated to Twitter, and you, and it's like, what is left
to us? Do you think journalism can be saved? Do you think? Yeah. I mean, I do wonder. I mean, it is interesting. Here we are, and we're down just the last couple of minutes here. But here we are on radio, terrestrial
down, the ship
radio,
is
and a lot of people don't even own radios anymore. And yet, at the same time, this radio station still survives for now. And I think it's because we're listener funded. We're funded. We just ask people to give us what they can.
Yeah.
And not everyone can, but some do. Some give a lot. And I think that has at least momentarily saved us from what has happened to other commercial outlets.
Yes, you guys are one of the last sort of survivors, a sort of island of sanity, in my opinion. And I would say the same thing about independent bookstores.
Yeah.
And I would say, I mean, there are some surviving publications here and there that I admire and that I like a lot. By the way, they don't have a lot of these same problems they don't have in other countries. I mean, in France, newspapers are hurting and everything, but bookstores, for example, bookstores survive over there. They're thriving. They're doing great. Not every country is seeing its institutions of knowledge transmission fall apart in the way that ours have in this country. To end on a really depressing, oblivion sort of note,
yeah.
In a book I wrote called The Wrecking Crew, I was focused on the career of Jack Abramoff, who was a super lobbyist that fell into disgrace in the Bush years. And one of the things that he did was he had a lot of newspaper columnists he had compromised them in various ways, and they would write stories about what he asked them to write about. And one of them said in his defense, look, every institution in this city, in the city of Washington, is compromised. Every institution. And I remember when I wrote about that, I sneered at that. I'm like, no way. I mean, come on. We've still got a lot of, you know, there's a lot of integrity in academia, and there's integrity in this and in that. And I think he was right now. I think that in some ways that Washington model, where every think tank is paid for, is basically a lobbyist front nowadays. And every newspaper, you know, serves somebody. I mean, the Post is owned by Bezos now. That is the model.
Yeah.
Newspapers owned by billionaires. You know, think tanks as
lobbyists. Well, I feel like, and we are out of time, but I feel like we all need a patron now. Back in the medieval times, what we need now is a patron.
Yeah, it's inequality. Inequality come
money
home
to help
us.
Fund us to do this type of work. Thomas Frank, thank you.
Mitch, it was my pleasure to be here.
The pleasure was ours. Thomas Frank has been our guest. His latest book is called Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Thank you. Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich.
And you have been listening to Letters and Politics. It airs every afternoon at 6 p.m. on WMNF's HD3 channel, The Source. Radioactivity with Rob Laurie will be back tomorrow to take your calls. Stay tuned for Midpoint with Mark Bureau, Executive Session with John Gilmore. Nancy C. kicks off our music block starting today at 2 o'clock. All of this will come up following NPR News. You are listening to WMNF Tampa, handpicked, homegrown music and news.
Live from NPR News in Washington.